Again, actually 2 weeks ago, we began our discussion of 1 Peter, the 4th chapter, with the point initially that our response to the suffering of Jesus Christ is to ourselves be characteristically as He is. Whereas this is a response that is brought about as we recognize what it is that He has done for us, as we recognize our similarities as He suffered in the flesh, and it is our inevitable lot to, as His disciples, suffer as well. Sense of obligation that we have as a result of what Christ has done for us. When we talk about the extension of God's grace, we are told that the grace of God that brings salvation has appeared to all men, and it teaches us that we are to deny ungodliness and worldly lusts and live soberly and righteously. So that is our response to what Christ has done for us. And that, I think, is indicated in verse 1, that since Christ suffered for us in the flesh, we are to arm ourselves with the same mind as Christ. For he who has suffered in the flesh has ceased from sin. So as he defines what the same mind is, he puts it in this context as referencing the similarities that we are to have to Christ in His righteousness. He was righteous, He was sinless, because we are His disciples, because of what He has done for us. We are also to stop sinning, no longer live our lives characteristically in the flesh and as the people of the world do, but instead to live differently. So I want you to keep that in mind. Notice verse 2. As Christians, we should no longer live the rest of our time in the flesh for the lust of men, but for the will of God. For we have spent enough of our past lifetime in doing the will of the Gentiles. And so this is just a simple statement that because of what Christ has done for us and suffering for us, we too are to take on His mind and recognize that if we are indeed Christians, if we're indeed disciples of His, servants of His, then we are to live lives that are characteristically righteous. That is to be contrasted with the life that we have lived in the past. And I do want you to note especially that statement in verse 3 because of the application that the writer draws to that. And we can make a very broad application. We spend enough of our lifetime living as the Gentiles live. Lusting as the Gentiles lusted. So we look at our world today, and we look at individuals who are not religious, those who are worldly minded. We look at the type of lives that they live, what is characteristic of their indulgence of the flesh, their willfulness and selfishness with regard to doing whatever it is that they desire to do. And we recognize it for what it is and determine that as Christians, we're no longer going to live that way. We're going to live a life that is different. And that is the call of sanctification. When we look at passages like this, I want you to remember, we've established this principle time and again, Peter, and we'll look at it again as we continue our study of Peter, and that is that that we are to be holy because God is holy. And that's, of course, again, the sentiment or the basis of all of this. If we indeed call ourselves servants of Christ, then we are to be as He is. This call to sanctification should show a person to be different. The world should be able to recognize it. Those who see us and consider our lives and our demeanor and our behavior should be able to look at us and say, you know, that person is not a normal person. That person is not like other people are in the way he behaves, how he conducts himself, what his priorities are, who his friends are, the things that he spends his life doing. And so as Christians, when we are compared to the world, there should be something that is manifestly different in our lives in person than what we see that is characteristic of worldly people. I wouldn't necessarily say this is a litmus test, but I think this is something that is characteristically so and something that can be characteristically seen. And so if an individual who calls himself a Christian lives in such a way as to those who are looking at his life, those who are examining his life, see no difference, perceive no distinctiveness with regard to his life that he lives, that there is perhaps something amiss and something we certainly need to be concerned about. Now, having said that, we spent the latter part of our class last time talking about the use of alcohol. And you'll remember that the reason for that is because the application that he makes in this, as he says, we spent enough of our time, past lifetime, in doing the will of the Gentiles. The use of alcohol is in the list that he gives in the latter part of verse 3. We talk about lewdness and lusts, those things that have reference to sexual immorality and sensuousness. Then there are three words, drunkenness, revelries, and drinking parties that involve themselves in the use of alcohol. And then finally, abominable idolatries. Of course, idol worship can be in the literal sense of taking a graven image and giving obeisance to a deity, a pagan deity. But as the Apostle Paul indicated when he said, for example, covetousness is idolatry, that idolatry can also be present in an individual's life when anything, whatever it may be, is put in a position of preeminence before God. And that could be money, it could be a pursuit of happiness, it could be the pursuit of wisdom, it could be our family, anything like that. If it takes the place of God, it is, by definition, an abominable idolatry. So those things are things that I think are very obvious and very clear concerning the lewdness and the lusts and the abominable idolatries. But we do need to spend some time discussing those three words that are used to describe alcohol use and determine what they mean and what the prohibition actually is. Now, as you go on in verse 4, you'll note in verses 4 and 6, it says, in regard to these, they think it strange that you do not run with them in the same place of dissipation and speak evil of them. And they will give an account to him who is ready to judge the living and the dead. We will again state that concerning this, let's just say this. If you have had in your past worldly friends, and you become a Christian or you are a Christian, and you begin to act like a Christian ought to act, then you will soon see that your worldly friends are no longer comfortable in your presence. They don't want to be around you. They don't want to listen to your testimony or your proclamation of truth. They are not interested in taking part in your pursuit of righteousness. And they will think you to be a peculiar individual. And I think that this is, while there are some who would show respect for an individual who is righteous in his life, when we're told that evil companionship corrupts good morals, there is a lot of truth to be said in that a Christian who is acting like a Christian when he is among others who are in the world will not be welcome, will not be accepted, will not fit in. And again, this is something that I try to address with regard to young people, because young people especially are around immoral people in school. They're around immoral people almost all the time and all the different social situations they find themselves in. And the fact is that if you fit in, that may be an indication that there's something that is amiss. It is an indication there's something amiss with regard to your demonstration of your faith. And I've seen it time and again that if you demonstrate your faith as God would that you do, then they will not want to be around you. They will no longer consider you a friend. And that kind of solves its own problem. Either they will have an honest heart and themselves will be touched and convicted and thus change, or else they will hate the light, love the darkness, and despise the light as a result of the fact that it exposes their sin. It's very, very difficult to be a faithful Christian and to be on friendly terms in the sense of companionship and desire to be with one another and such with those who are in the world. It just doesn't work that way because the world and righteousness does not mix. But that it is possible for Christians to be friendly with those in the world by loving the world and by living lives that are not characteristically different. And that's exactly what he's speaking against here in this text when he says you've done that long enough, now you're to change. So with that in mind, I do want to spend just a few moments looking at the three terms that are used in verse 3 concerning the use of alcohol. The three that are given as they are translated in the New King James Version are drunkenness, revelries, and drinking parties. If you have a King James Version, it's drunkenness, revelings, instead of revelries, and banqueting, rather than drinking parties. And the banqueting is kind of a little bit of an archaic term, though we understand of what banquets are and go to them on occasion. And in fact, perhaps, is a very good way of interpreting or translating that particular text. A couple of things to note. First of all, let's go through and look at the definitions of the term. The term drunkenness comes from, is kind of a compound term in the Greek. You know that the term for wine in the Greek is oinos, O-I-N-O-S, if you look at the anglicized spelling of the Greek. And so the idea of oinos and then the term phlugia, P-H-L-U-G-I-A, again, the anglicized spelling. And so the idea of phlugia has reference to an excess, an overflow. And oinos would be wine. So it would be an excess of wine or a surplus of wine. And in fact, the etymology or the derivative of those terms is, in fact, what the actual definition is in this particular case. When you talk about an individual who is drunk, he there are so many terms that can be used to describe them, and are. He is plastered. He is wasted. The idea of being under the influence, having an individual's senses dulled or distorted as a result of the drinking of an excess of wine. So a drunk is a drunk, and I think, although some might say, well, okay, how much do you take before you're drunk? When you see people acting the way they do, you can say, well, I may not exactly know the amount of alcohol, but I know a drunk when I see one. And so we recognize what is the case there. And I doubt very seriously that there's any confusion, nor is there any controversy surrounding the fact that drunkenness is sinful. And when we see an individual who is a Christian who is drunk with wine, we recognize that very clearly to be sinful. Sinful thing. So drunkenness is one that I think we can have an agreement with and understand easily. The second term, which is revelries, comes from a Greek word. You spell it K-O-M-O-S, again the anglicized komos. And it means a carousal, as if letting loose. You heard the phrase letting your hair down. Definition continues, a reveling or a rioting. And so I want you to think about that as letting loose and rioting. And if I were to give an equivalency to the idea of revelries, we would take Carnival in Rio de Janeiro or some other Hispanic or Spanish setting, and then Mardi Gras.
Say that's a good example.
That's a very good example. Mardi Gras would be another example. Or if you want to become less ethnic, then spring break. Just with regard to the practice that that happens every spring when college students get a week and go down to a beach or a coast and basically spend the entire time letting loose and rioting. It's an amazing thing to see too when you look at the cleanup that is necessary with regard to all of these activities, and you know, how many people do things that they normally wouldn't do, how many people that are put into jail because of lewd and obscene behavior or because of public intoxication, and those kinds of things. This also is an indication of something that that carries intrinsic in the term the idea of excess. And I think that can be seen in the idea of letting loose or rioting.
Frat party.
A frat party would be another exact cake party, you know, those kinds of things. And it is kind of an interesting thing when you look at when you look at drinking patterns, that those drinking patterns, they change depending upon age groups. That those who are young, when we're talking about, it's a sad thing, but even middle school, there are children who are active in drinking alcohol. But let's take as an example those who are in high school, and especially those in college. What is characteristic in that time is called binge drinking. Individuals become enamored with just that, that getting drunk and getting the buzz and acting ridiculous. And that's kind of to many people, one of the, what you call it, things you go through when you're growing up. And so it's something very much a characteristic. Now, later on, when individuals are engaging those activities, it's considered problematic when adults do that, and maybe an indication of alcoholism or a life that is out of control. But it's almost a rite of passage. I knew I was going to come up with that. A rite of passage with regard to young people to binge drink. So, you know, that kind of thing is something that it certainly might have a correlation with the first term of drunkenness, because it is, again, something that is characteristic of excess. But at the same time, you have an individual who drinks to get drunk. And we look at an individual like that who may be lying in the gutter as we drive by, and we think of that person as really a sorry individual, a sad case, a sad situation, someone with a problem. But then there are others who consider themselves normal, consider themselves perhaps productive, not having a problem, who nevertheless make the decision from time to time to party. And whatever it may be, it's an indication of excess, often accompanied by lewd and lascivious behavior, but it is characteristic of drinking to excess as well. That's the reveling that is mentioned in the second part of it. Yes, Colin?
I had a side thought, so to speak. I thought of a character which we all know of, Otis Campbell, from the Andy Griffith Show. And even though his character, when he was drinking in excess, his character seemed to be fine or in check, we must remember that not only can we harm our character, but we can, Jimmy, Otis was not harmed by his activity or whatever, but his body, the body can be harmed.
Yeah, and I think that when you do the Hollywood depiction of the funny drunk, you know, and we think about that, and we have a number of examples of that. Otis would be an example. Not everyone here knows who Otis is, but most of us do. There may be a few young that don't know.
You're still on.
He is a man that had a jail cell that was his whenever he wanted it, kind of like going home, and the sheriff would allow him to sleep it off in the jail cell and leave the jail door unlocked, and he'd come and go as he pleased. But he also, even in that depiction of it, was someone you felt sorry for, even behind the humor. Foster Brooks would be another example, and there are others. But there is something funny about pratfalls, and there is something funny about, you know, in that depiction. But you think about a person who actually is that way, who every conversation, and they can't keep down a job, and they're by themselves, they're alone, and they're dysfunctional as adults because all they do is drink. Well, that's the first one in that list, and it's destructive to the body. You know, you never hear about Otis having a job or having a, actually, he may have had a wife, seemed like he did, but she didn't want him around when he was drunk. So it's destructive to relationships and things like that. And then the revelings, again, while it is considered sometimes a rite of passage or something people only do on occasion, it is nevertheless something that is marred by excess and bad decisions that take place as a result of being under the influence. So those two have reference to the use of alcohol with regard to amount. And the amount in both of those cases has excess amount that is in excess. Yes.
I think
another thing to point out, particularly on the binge drinking, sin can always find a way to pull us in. But people who binge drink and make the plan to do it aren't being pulled in. They're leaping toward it. And that designated drivers, I mean, I'm grateful that the drunks aren't on the road, but the fact is, I've made a plan to sin. I'm going to go get drunk, but I'll make sure I have somebody that can drive me so I won't get killed in the process. So it's not even Satan sneaking up on us and luring us. It's the willing leap.
Well, when you hear the slogan of the beer companies and all the commercials now, to drink responsibly, and then you recognize what is defined by drinking responsibly, and that is, in effect, don't drink and drive. Drink to the point to where you can't walk straight. You certainly shouldn't be behind a car, and your senses are dulled. Your judgment is impaired. Just make sure there is someone there when you do that to take your keys away from you and not let you kill anybody. That's drinking responsibly. That's just kind of an absurd thing, but that's the world's definition. That's the way the Gentiles look at drinking. That's the point. That's the very thing that we're talking about here. They think, if you say, okay, let's redefine this, what is responsible behavior? Let's look at it differently. They think that you're weird, you're peculiar. Why in the world would you kill our fun? Why are you being a stick in the mud? Well, what's wrong with you? You know, that's the kind of attitude that people have when you bring up these words of caution. But that's something that should be prevalent with regard to the Christian, a different way of looking at things. Okay, the third word in this list that is translated drinking parties or banqueting is the Greek word potos, P-O-T-O-S. And there are a couple of things that are interesting in this. The first is the simplicity of the definition. It is a drinking. Simply that, a drinking or banqueting. So I want you to consider the concept of the banquet. What happens at a banquet? Well, now we have a banquet that I've gone to for years that is put on by the school. It's the banquet that the spring sports, since Jeremiah and all of my kids are involved in the various spring sports, we've been doing this for a number of years. Well, that banquet, nothing wrong with it. I mean, there's nothing wrong with going to a banquet. We have meals, food, some good, some not so good, depending on who caters the meal. And we give out awards and things like that. But that's not what the course is being referred to here. But that is the kind of social setting that this word is considering. Now, when adults go to a banquet, what do they do? They go and they sit down and they have their, $50 plate dinner or whatever it is, and then they have wine or alcohol as a part of it. And the interesting thing about this particular text is that it is a word which describes typical Gentile behavior. How many of you have been told with regard to office parties or banquets, office parties or banquets, of which you are associated, you have a big or a small business, but the boss who sets it all up or determines we're going to have it expects you to be there. You're expected to be at the banquet. You're expected to be at the office party. That's something where attendance is required. And what is it characteristically? It's people standing around, visiting, sitting, eating, and drinking. It's called also social drinking. That's a term that we use commonly in our day to describe what is stated here with regard to banqueting. Now again, the term here, a drinking, does not have reference to amount. It's not talking about getting drunk. It's not talking about letting your hair down or losing control. It is simply talking about drinking in a social situation. That is characteristically a Gentile behavior. That's what the Gentiles do. And that is something where he is saying here, don't you do that. Don't be involved in those kinds of things. That's what they do. That's what they expect. They will look at you peculiarly if you say, I don't want to do that. I don't want to drink. I'm not going to drink alcohol. There are some Christians, and they have admitted this to me and to others on occasion, is I go to these things, and I don't want to drink, but I don't want to get in trouble or to be made fun of or to be looked at in a particular way. So I get a glass that is being used for alcohol, and I pour something in it other than alcohol, and I hold that and I drink that, where it looks like I'm drinking. They've admitted to the fact that it looks like I'm drinking, but I'm not, because I don't want to drink, but I want to be perceived as one of the group. I don't want to be marked as different, or perhaps get into trouble with the boss because I'm not being a good sport about these kinds of things. And there are people who feel those kinds of pressures, and they succumb to those kinds of pressures with regard to their influence. I want you to recognize that the idea or the desire, the concern, not to stand out, not to suffer consequence as a result of our faith, not to be looked at as peculiar or different, not to suffer persecution for your faith, is antithetical to what we're called to. In fact, we are supposed to be drawing attention to our faith, standing out from the world, being different, having our lives and demeanor characteristically different from those in the world. So we should not be participating in those activities that are characteristically the same as the Gentiles, those immoral people. And that's what's under consideration here. It's the idea of influence, it's the idea of standing out and being different and not conforming to the world. And that's a principle that is inviolate. It is one that we must accept and heed. In Romans chapter 12, verses 1 and 2, we're not to be conformed to the world, but be transformed by the renewing of our minds. We're not to be like people who are in the world. We're supposed to be different from people in the world. And again, the desire to fit in, while it is understandable, because everyone has that tendency, is one that we must fight against and work against, because it doesn't fit the idea of having Christ as your master and being different from the world. That's the point that he's making here. And so we could say, and I think that the text and the term that is used there would indicate it's not only wrong to be a drunk, it's also wrong to engage in rioting, the Mardi Gras, the parties, those kinds of things. But it's also wrong for a Christian to put himself in a situation where he is drinking socially, because you cannot be that influence that Peter says that we are to be when you're engaging in social drinking. You are accepted in that situation, that scenario, as being like everyone else, one of the gang, because your life is the same as their life. You're doing what they're doing. You say, we've done that long enough, now it's time to stop doing that. Okay? Yes, go.
Another side thought. Mr. Foster gave us a visit, and he was talking about perception, and as you become a Christian, you will be perceived, and you will not know how many people you are affecting.
But it's very valid, and I think applicable to this particular circumstance. And we do need to remember this. No matter when you live your life as a Christian, and you're really doing a good job, and you're living righteously, and you're being this good example, you have absolutely no idea who's going to see that and who is going to be affected by it. I don't know if you remember in the sermons that Chip preached, but there was one point that he made about a young man who had been greatly influenced by him. And when Chip had his interactions with this young man, he had no concept or idea that that was the case. It was gratifying to him that it was something that he was not aware of until it was told him. And believe me, I feel that same way with individuals, saying them with my preaching. It doesn't seem like it's getting through at all, but I have on a number of occasions been told later on that greatly helpful when they have reached a period of maturity or a determination to change, that the words that I had said on a particular occasion meant a lot to them. Well, that's the kind of thing that we're talking about. If that is the case, then the converse can be true. That if a Christian who is supposed to be this pillar of righteousness, this wonderful example, this light of the world, his behavior seems to be different from his profession as a child of God. Then there are individuals who may see that and be inappropriately influenced, discouraged, and you may not even have any idea that it ever happened. Can you imagine standing in the Day of Judgment and becoming aware of an individual who lost their faith or began that digression and drifting as a result of something that they saw you do? And it may be that that progression and doesn't dismiss their responsibility in the matter, but that digression took a while, and it may be that they had moved away, you weren't even aware of them. Someone perhaps you did not know well, but because of something that you did, some way you acted, some inappropriate word you said, some anger that you showed, some compromise with the world, led them to think, well, I don't have to be quite as righteous as what I thought, because look at brother so-and-so there, look what they've done. And as such, you started that process. It'd be a horrible thing, but that is a burden that we bear, that we are to be the light of the world. If you were to think about that, if someone were to come to you in a different context and say, okay, this is the burden that I'm laying on you. It is your responsibility to be the light of the world. It is your responsibility to be the salt of the earth. Now, I'm not saying we're that by ourselves, but we are certainly to be. That's a big obligation. What it means is, it doesn't matter who it is that's looking at you. When they see you, they should glorify God because of the things that you have done in the body. They see you, and they give glory to God. And that's your responsibility as a Christian. Okay, now how do you conduct yourself? How do you live? How much do you think about what you're going to wear? How much do you think about where you're going to go? How much do you think about what you're going to say or who you're going to be with or what you're going to do? If you realize that all eyes are on you and that it's your responsibility, God-given responsibility, to influence those individuals to good, to present the proper example all the time in regard to what it is to be a Christian and live a Christian life. Yes, Sam?
Sometimes the things we do may not cause someone to do wrong, but sometimes by what we do, we don't help someone do right. For instance, one time I was in a scenario like that where there was drinking, and I ordered a soda. And, you know, I'm used to being rude about it. I don't really care. I'm not interested in drinking, and I'm not going to do that to accommodate someone else. But there was a girl there that had always hated drinking. She didn't like the taste of it. Felt pressure whenever she was with this group to do it. And because I didn't do it, she had the strength to not do it as well. Because she's no longer alone. So sometimes you don't know who out there would do better if we just hold the line and don't give up and don't give in. You know, we can help someone else do right. And we miss that opportunity.
Yeah, I appreciate that very much, and that's a good point to make. I've got a tendency to want to even take it further than that. I've got a point that I want to make in this regard. I want you to turn with me very quickly over to 1 Corinthians. And we're going to look there in 1 Corinthians at verses 9 and following of that text. 1 Corinthians chapter 5, I'm sorry. Verses 9 and following. Now, I'm aware of the fact that there are times when you find yourselves in situations, whether it be socially or whatever, where some of this stuff is going on. And the case, of course, in that is to hold the line and not do them. I do want to point out that it's important for us to strive to be out, not be in those kinds of situations at all. And that's the point that I'm making. But there's a text here in 1 Corinthians chapter 5 and beginning of verse 9 when he says, I told you in my epistle not to keep company with sexually immoral people. That makes sense, doesn't it? You want to be around individuals who are fornicators and adulterers and, and homosexuals and things like that. She didn't want to be around people like that. But he says in verse 10, he said, I certainly didn't mean with the sexually immoral people in the world. So Paul's saying, when I told you not to be around sexually immoral people, so I wasn't saying to stay away from the sexually immoral people in the world. Well, what does that mean? Does it mean that we go to the bars and that we go to the places where people who are ungodly are? And you know, there are individuals today who will say that. They say, you know, Jesus, he went to the sinners. Yeah, but he didn't go to bars. You know, I mean, he was around sinners. And this is a problem I think sometimes Christians have with this, is the idea that I can be around ungodly people because I like ungodly people. I like being around ungodly people. You know, these people are my friends, and it's okay for me to be around them because after all, Jesus was. Well, what was Jesus doing when he was around the ungodly people? He's preaching to them. And I want to tell anyone who is here, if they have a desire to be around ungodly people like Jesus was, do it. That's great. That's what should be done. You're out in the world, you're around those kinds of individuals, but let me tell you something. If you do it like Jesus did, chances are you'll have the same result. They'll put you on the cross. Or they're going to persecute you as a result of it. If you push yourself to where you stay around them and preach to them and tell them that their lives are not as they should be and they need to repent, then they're going to eventually say, we don't want you around anymore. So the problem is not being out there with those individuals. Of necessity, we have to be. We work with them. We go to the grocery store, they're there. We get out on our front porch and they're there in the neighborhood, they're our neighbors. These kinds of individuals are all present. And in order to avoid them entirely, you would have to come out of the world. That's what Paul's saying here. You can't just leave that. But recognize this, that your purpose when you're among these individuals is not to cultivate friendship and relationships, not to curry their favor, not to try to enlighten them, but rather to convert them to Christ. And the same apostle here said, you're going to have to be out with people in the world, is the same one that said, evil companionship corrupts good morals. So we should, though we have involvement with people in the world, we're around them all of the time, we should not consider them our companions. They are not the ones that we should desire this constant association with and this feeling of kinship and this desire to be with for the purpose of engaging in recreation or pastime. Because that's trying to be like the world. And you cannot serve two masters. You're going to hate one, despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. And if you try to do that, then it's going to cause a great deal of problems with regard to Christian influence, and it's also going to corrupt you. And that's the point that's being made here. So yes, I mean, we have to be around ungodly people, but our point in being there is to try to influence them to righteousness, not to be their friends or to enjoy their companionship. And I just wondered about that. You have a weak Christian or a Christian who, you know, friends getting together and he wants to go with them, so they decide they're going to go to a bar and, well, he's going to go there, but he's not going to drink, and so he's got a Coke in his hand. Now, what if on that occasion that Christian were to begin, I want to talk to y'all about the Bible. I want to share with you what Christ did and call you to repentance and show you where this kind of life that you're leading here is you're getting your buzz on is something that's inappropriate and unacceptable to God. What's going to happen in that situation? They're going to tell you lies. Because they don't want you there. And that's the thing, it always bothers me about, especially young Christians who are influenced by this, they want to be liked. Why would you want to be with people who, if you aren't like them, don't want you around? It just doesn't make sense to me. So be different. Find those who, when you're different, like you for being different, because they're different, and they love you because of who you are as a professing Christian. And be their companions and their friends, and that's where the emphasis should be. Yes,
in the military, you put up a lot of that because these people around you, you have to depend on them, and when it comes down to it, they're it. Yeah. But guess what? You can be the designated driver, and soon people start coming to you. You take them home, you take care of them, but and try to talk to them, but
yeah.
But and help the chaplain.
Yeah, yeah. Well, see, that's just it. There are times when there are certain obligations, and this is, you are in the world. That's what Paul is saying here. You're in the world. You have to be around them, but you don't have to be like them. That's the point that's being made here in this particular context. I'm not so concerned with individual situations where, because of military obligation, because of job obligation or whatever, that I am in a situation where I'm around people who are acting in an ungodly way and required to be there, or whatever the situation may be. What I'm concerned with is Christians who want to be in that situation and who do not stand out, want to hide you've got a Christian who doesn't. I'll tell you something about that too. That if you've got an individual who acts that way, then other than maybe the military conscripts and individuals who are required in that regard, we're talking about social situations in companies and all. If you're that particular way, there are going to be people who want you there, and the boss is finally going to say, you're excused. You know, if you're consistent with regard to that, okay, you don't have to come to these things because they don't want you there because you're acting the way you should and your light is shining. It's just the ones who just don't think there's anything wrong with it, not concerned about it, and want to be there, and they want to be like them, and they want to engage in those kinds of activities. That's the absolute opposite attitude to that which Peter's calling us in this particular passage. You spend enough of your past lifetime doing that kind of thing. Now, be different. That's what he's calling us for. And either as a result of that, there will be respect and perhaps repentance on the part of those individuals you influence rightly, or else they'll tell you to get lost because they hate the light and love the darkness. But this idea that I can go along and get along and be like them and still please God is something that's simply not true. And a passage such as this makes it very clear. Okay? Yes, Dick?
Well, there's several scriptures dealing with it, with this, but there's two in particular I want to comment on that Paul wrote to the Romans. One's in chapter 13, and the other one's in chapter 6 of Romans. And the first one in Romans 13, verses 13 and 14, where it speaks about the vibrancy, drunkenness, lewdness, and all that. And the person says, well, yeah, I drank a beer. I only have, but on these special occasions, you know, like a Thomas party, whatever, I only have maybe one or two drinks. But they ignore verse 14, where it says, make no provision for the flesh. If you just have one drink, whether it's a beer or whatever, you're making provision for the flesh. And then when Paul wrote there in Romans 6:21, he speaks of, right here, talk about the will of the Gentiles, and he's talking about the fruits, which is, he goes a step further, where he says, what fruit did you have then, the things which you are now ashamed, for the end of those things is death. So he's talking about being ashamed of these things that's in 1 Peter and other places like that. So he goes a step further. In fact, Chip mentioned that when he fell away and left the church, and things he wouldn't even want to talk about or whatever.
Right.
And we are ashamed of those things that we did along that line.
Yeah. Dick, those are two very, very good passages. And I do want to emphasize, as he mentioned there in Romans chapter 13, just in case anyone did not hear that, the proper walk is the opposite of what we looked at in 1 Peter chapter 4. In fact, two of those same terms are used, revelry and drunkenness, ambition, lewdness and lust, and in strife and envy. But notice in verse 14, as he talked about, we're to make no provision for the flesh to fulfill this lust. That's an indication that we're to stay as far away from it as we possibly can. And the contrast that he didn't emphasize, that I want to add to it, that's why I came back to it, is the first part of that phrase, put on the Lord Jesus Christ. And again, that kind of simplifies things. You are putting on Jesus Christ. I mean, he's supposed to be on, always, as far as in the sense of I'm stepping out the front door, and I'm presenting myself to the public, whoever it is out there. So I have as a cloak, I have as a part of my being, as a part of my person, as a part of my presentation to the world, Jesus Christ. Okay, now how am I going to act? When those situations arise, when someone says, come on, let's go do this. When someone says, why aren't you this way? When someone says, I don't see anything wrong with it. How are you going to respond if you have put on the Lord Jesus Christ? And that's what it all comes down to. This is why it is so disturbing to me to have individuals come up. And again, it is something that I've dealt with again and again and again and again. Do you want to argue the use of alcohol? Let's go to 1 Peter chapter 4. I've got some arguments that I think can show you that social drinking is sinful. But I want to talk about something a little bit different. I want to talk about being different from the world. I want to talk about the calling to which you're called. I want to talk about what people should see in you when you have put on the Lord Jesus Christ. That's what I said at the beginning of our study, is we're talking now about holiness. God said, be therefore holy, for I am holy. God is perfect and is holy in righteousness. Holiness and righteousness, and we are to seek to emulate Him. If that is the case, it is not possible for us to do so and make the provision for those things that are characteristically worldly or of the Gentiles. It just doesn't make any sense to be that way. And when you have, and that's why I say, when you have a Christian who's saying, how far can I go without crossing the line? Or what's so bad about? Or why can't we just do this? Or it doesn't seem to me that this is all that bad. That the whole mindset that they have, that they're exhibiting, is a worldly mindset that is not in keeping with the Apostle Paul's profession that I'm going to put on Jesus Christ, and as I walk out in the world, they're going to see God in me. And it's a matter of mindset. If you're a dedicated, faithful, mature Christian, then those types of things that are characteristic of the Gentiles are things you're not going to want anything to do with, because of your standing as a mature, faithful Christian. And individuals who are saying, I just don't see, or why can't I, or it seems to me, and they're trying to in some way blur the line or get as close as possible to that line that differentiates what is acceptable and unacceptable behavior, they just got the entire wrong idea about what it is to be a Christian. It's not a, let's find out what the bare minimum is. It's giving Christ my all that is required of us. That's preaching, isn't it? Preaching is the teaching itself. This is something that is of a great concern to me. It's something that I think we need to recognize and understand. I think that it's especially important for young people because of the pull of our godly society and the fact that the young people are especially vulnerable to peer pressure. By no means is it exclusively a problem with regard to young people. I know that those who are older have come into those same situations where there is that pressure and that desire to, you know, fit in, the desire not to. It's not so much that you want to fit in, you just don't want to be hassled, you know, and the problem it's going to cause by taking a stand. But that's what it is to be a Christian. And we need to recognize and accept it. All right, any other comments, questions? So what we will do then, as we note the truthfulness of these statements, going back there to 1 Peter 4, we're going to spend just a few moments talking about verses 4 through 6, but especially verse 6 when we come back next time. Get into the next section. Thank you very much for your kind attention and comments in class today.